Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. On this episode, our topic of the week is villain origin stories, who we want to see, and if this concept is a fluke. Plus, we debate if Netflix is even built to handle live streaming events and reviews of Armor, followed by our spoiler-free and spoiler-re discussion of Wicked, possibly the biggest film of the holiday season, if Troy has anything to say about it. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me today, my fellow host, Troy Davenport, Troy Heidritz.
Did they get married?
Yeah. Congratulations, guys. It's a new world.
Yeah. We had a baby couch. It's what we had. Hello. How is everybody? And it'll be the biggest movie of 2024.
Of the whole year.
That
means it has to be Deadpool and Wolverine, man. That's 600 plus million domestic.
It might. I don't know if it'll do it in time by the end of the year, but.
Okay.
Totality and it will.
Lofty goal. We'll find out more when we get to the end of the episode because that's where Wicked is. Check your timestamps if you want to get right to that review. Amanda Sink is also here.
Hello, hello.
She did not see it because she is, in fact, Wicked.
I actually am glad that there's some early reviews out before I go see it. I don't fully trust Troy, so I'm taking it almost with a grain of salt. Sometimes I feel like if he has a bias to it, he leans into it a little bit harder. And I do the same thing too, so it's okay. But that's where I'm like, I need somebody who's not as familiar with the property and loves it as though it's something beloved. I want to hear somebody who's like not fully interested in it.
Do I count?
Yes.
I saw it.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Oh.
I'm glad we have you guys who are reviewing it early.
I liked it a lot.
Which is good. That's what I needed to hear.
There you go. Wow, Troy. That's gotta hurt your feelings a little bit. If you would like to vent or, you know, kick her off the show, I totally understand. And we'll just take a vote.
What the fuck? That went from 0 to 100 super
quick.
We're
escalating exponentially. That's what's going on.
Yes. Real quickly.
Just kidding. No, John Davenport won't be here this week, by the way. Because he's off on that couch that they had together. Celebrating.
Doing whatever he's doing.
Sweet matrimony.
And let's be clear, I'm here. He's the one that's not here. So it would be more like our John Heinrichs. He'd take my last name.
I should have laughed that hard because it took way too long for you to get to that joke, but I'll let you have it because it still made me laugh. it's a great time for movie theaters, man, because just so you know, we will not be here next week. So enjoy the holidays, everyone. Please have a wonderful Thanksgiving, if you celebrate. If you do not, I understand why, because it's a messed up holiday. Let's not talk about it. But thank you to everybody for supporting the show, and go out and see movies in theaters. You've got Moana 2, you've got Gladiator 2, you've got Wicked. There's a lot of stuff you can see in a theater. So it's a good time. Speaking of, Denzel is out there promoting Gladiator 2, and he's promising every movie in the world. He's going to be in a Black Panther 3. Ryan Coogler's going to write him a part there.
I saw this.
Yeah, this is great. He's just like, I'm in everything. I'm in everything, and then I'm going to retire. That's the thing I love.
I'm going to retire after I do this. And then
16
this,
movies.
But also this.
I'm going to retire. I got 16 movies left, and then I'm out. He promised Equalizer 4 and 5. He didn't even just say 4. He said, I'm going to do Equalizer 4 and 5. That's a quote.
That's so a spoiler.
We are
first
getting
of
them.
All.
We're getting them. Well, he may be shooting them back to back. I don't know. But good for, I like those movies. So bring them on.
Yeah, I do. They're good movies.
I wonder if Queen Latifah, because she has the Equalizer TV show, if she ever just runs into Denzel and says, bitch, I want movies too. You need to leave so I can get to the big screen.
Seriously.
And he's just like, no. People want them. I give the people what they want. Speaking of sequelizing everything to death, Kevin Smith, he was at a recent festival and started spouting his mouth like he does. God bless him. And he basically said that he's writing or he's beginning to write Dogma 2, and that one, to make it work, he really needs Matt Damon and Ben Affleck to return. And he said, quote, "Some people will be like, don't fucking touch it. You'll ruin it. And I'm here to tell you, I will. I'm fucking tickled. I found a way in." And we should point out, he came out the next day and said, "I haven't actually talked to Ben Affleck and Matt Damon about this yet." So, you know, it's not really a go, but it's in his mind. But I guess my thing is, he's been trying to get the rights to this, for people that don't know, for a long time. Harvey Weinstein would not give him the rights because Harvey Weinstein, if you haven't heard, is a bit of a monster. But he has finally got the rights to Dogma. He's able to release a digital version so people can finally see Dogma again soon. And he wants to sequelize it, which he's doing with a lot of his movies. Is it a good idea though, Troy?
No. Dogma? No. Dogma is a lightning in a bottle. Ooh, I really feel like that was a movie that worked for the time that it was at. I feel like the characters and the players that you had in that movie, between, you know, Salma Hayek and Alanis Morissette, and of course Matt and Ben,
and the ship monster.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much in the time that it was 20 years ago. Like, the satire was happening in the 90s and things of that nature. It's just like, there's just so much stuff that made that work for then. I don't know how you do it now, especially given everything that happened with the election in the States. Like, that you don't really want to touch Christianity in a bad way, because you might have some people coming after you. So I don't really know how this is going to spin in order to make it interesting, especially when you already had like Good Omens on Amazon Prime, right? We already had like, How Do Angels Get Back into Heaven? Like, this story has been out there numerous times. Like, it has to be a different story. So like, what is the different story? And if you come up with a different story, then maybe it works. I don't know. But the fact that it's Dogma 2, no. Call it something completely different. Don't attach it to Dogma at all.
As much as I would love another Dogma, I don't think I have enough faith in Kevin Smith himself, actually, to give me something that meets or exceeds the original Dogma, which I think, it, you know, speaks a little bit to Troy's point in that it is magic in a bottle. And how could you possibly replicate that? You know, I think they could make an interesting story out of it and use modern times and kind of replicate it in that way. But do I think that I have enough faith in him to do that versus taint my opinion on the original? I mean, I just don't trust him, truthfully. I love him. Don't get me wrong. Love his work, all that. But his old work ain't his new work.
No, it's not. And I would rather, I love the concept of Dogma more. I would prefer to hand the reins off to younger indie filmmakers and let them take a stab at religion with the idea and make Dogma 2 that way. I think that could be more interesting, personally. Maybe if Jay and Silent Bob is part of it, I'd be down for that. But just to hand the reins over. Somebody like, you know, Scott Beck and Brian Woods, they just did a great job with Heretic, and maybe they can bring some kind of religious thematic overtures to Dogma. Just do something different a little bit. I don't know. We'll see. So let's talk about, I know it's a little overdue, right? It's old news. It was last week.
It is not old news.
Well, let's talk
Mike
about
Mike Tyson's ass cheeks on essentially national television will never be old news to me.
Oh, that's because that's all people looked at, because he didn't throw a punch the entire time.
He sure did not. No,
he did. Yeah. He did land one.
Okay, well, but hey, so let's preface this. All right, so last week, last Friday, a few days, but at the point of this recording, Mike Tyson and Jake Paul took to one of the most staged and just terrible fights in boxing history. One of those two. And Netflix decided to carry it live, which broke records, 60 million plus viewers, and streams, because it was buffering. I haven't seen buffering since AOL days. Like, it's been a while since I saw buffering on my TV, and it was an absolute mess.
And it wasn't even buffering. The whole thing was down.
That too.
It was down.
That too. It was both.
For like, up until like the fight started. And then thankfully they got it back up and running when the fight started, so nobody missed the fight. But yeah, it was buffering for the first two rounds. The system crashed.
Or 15 people here. I can't remember the numbers. I think it was like 15 people. And we could not watch it on television. Everyone had to watch it on their phones. Because for people that don't know, a mobile app and a TV app is different. They're all different. They compress different. Blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to go through all that for you, but they're different. The mobile app worked fine.
Yep.
But you couldn't watch it on TV. It was amazing.
My mobile on AT&T buffered in round one, and then it was fine by round two.
Really?
My friend's iPad on Verizon buffered in round one and round two, but very, like, buffer fix.
Ours,
it was, like, very quick.
It was buffering throughout the earlier fights, but once it got to Mike Tyson and Jake Paul, nothing. It was dead. Couldn't watch it on TV. Had to watch it on our phones. The whole fight. Ridiculous.
We never got the TV to work.
It was ridiculous.
So I had a different experience.
Okay.
And it's ironic because
you got them HD ass cheeks. You got that, huh?
Did you pay for the 4K subscription?
Who's the person on this podcast that has to turn their video off to improve the quality?
Yeah.
Because of their internet connection, well, other than me.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're going to have to explain that because people don't know.
Yeah. So for the record, I'm constantly being either fighting with the internet or being told
you're
that
buffering.
I'm
your audio buffering.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So because of all of that, I'm surprised that I had a better experience, but it was fine in the prelims. And when you got to the women's fight is when it started to taper and I had some issues.
That was a great fight.
It was a great fight. And also went to the wrong person, but we're not going to get into that right now.
Sure did. The other one won.
So, yep. Stolen. Mm-hmm. It was stolen.
It was robbed.
Anyhow. So that's when it started to kind of buffer and have some issues. I did have to, like, exit the app and go back into it, but then you could still watch the whole fight. There were some times where it would get, like, more pixelated, I guess I would say, like, less clear in resolution, and that was very annoying, but you could still make sense of what was going on. Get into the Mike Tyson and Jake Paul fight, and that's when I could tell it got significantly worse. I could still watch, you know, most of it. It was just, like, I had to pretty much, like, exit the screen and go right back in. So it was almost like pausing and playing. But that's how I kind of fixed it, is just, like, trying to toggle back and forth. And for whatever reason, it worked.
I can't fathom how a company as big as Netflix can't carry a live event without these problems. They swore they were ready for this. They swear
yes,
they're ready
but
for
can
this.
We not be grateful for the fact that I believe very intentionally they made sure that this fight occurred about a month before this big live stream for football is going to happen on Christmas Day. So they got to test their bandwidth with, honestly, an event that's going to get more streams than football's going to have. I believe that. And so they got to test their max capacity that they're going to be able to reach for this year and figure out how to fix it so that way they don't have issues going into it. They basically had a test run. Like, I'm actually kind of grateful because it's not like the fight was make it or break it. We all
made or broke my party. I'll tell you that. My party was broken. It was trash. Sure.
Look, I don't
Mike Tyson
I don't
agree. Beat the shit out of my party.
He didn't because he also stood there and just showed his ass off the entire time. But I usually don't, like, give in to Amanda's conspiracy theories, but I think Amanda's 100% right on this one. I think this was a test run.
Thank you.
For the football experiment.
They were originally going to do this in July. So I guess either way, you can look at it that way. But I don't care what the reasoning was. I'm telling you that the fight sucked to try to watch on a streaming platform that's supposed to be known for streaming, and it didn't stream.
I got news for you. Nothing happened until the seventh round anyway.
I get it. You aren't paying attention to my argument, though. Are you not? That
it's the principle of it.
It's bullshit. It was bullshit.
I didn't mind that the buffering. I mean,
bullshit. You can't tell me you didn't mind that.
I was more like, am I actually going to even see the fight? Because I didn't know to even go back to look to check to see if it was working because the system was down for the hour before the fight. Like, that's the bigger story. The fact that you couldn't get the thing to pull up at all.
That's true. It's terrible. And unless you watched it on your stupid phone. I just don't, I can't understand for the life of me. Okay. So it's Netflix, handle your business. All right. You better do it before Christmas. Cause I will not sit there and wait for it to correct. I'm out. I'll go somewhere else and do something else.
Fine, I feel like you're maybe being a tiny bit dramatic.
Amanda, the advertisement, hang on. Hold please.
Uh-huh.
Literally they've been advertising this fight all freaking year. It was supposed to happen back in July or whatever, and then, you know, he had medical issues, fine, so they postponed it. So now it's coming. They've been advertising the hell out of it. This is a big fight, an icon versus a dipshit and all this other stuff. Getting it all ready to go. Jake Paul's been doing everything he could to advertise it. Mike Tyson's been releasing clips where apparently he was boxing, you know, I don't know if that's AI or what, because it sure wasn't what he gave on the stage. And then I couldn't play the entire fight on my television that I pay Netflix for. Look, that's what I'm paying you for. And you can say, well, no, I pay Netflix. It should work. You advertise the shit out of it.
That's, the cost.
I have every right to be pissed about this. Every fucking right.
So dramatic.
Every fucking right. Every right. I got every right.
Paid $15 a month in order to get a whole bunch of stuff on Netflix versus like $60.
I paid
$23
a month. Thank you, sir.
That's what I was going to say. The money that that pay-per-view gets to be able to put on that quality of a stream of like a show actively live event is three times as much as what Netflix is getting. Not to mention Netflix
is
sharing
multiple
accounts. I'm just saying it's not comparable. They're doing something that's completely different than what else we have out here. So give them a little grace.
No, I'm not giving them any grace. I should have, at the very least, I would have been fine with fuzzy naked butt cheeks. Okay, I didn't even get pixelated butt cheeks. I got nothing.
Look,
nada.
There's a whole point to this conversation that people like don't even remember. Is that there was this whole concept about different internet providers having different taxes on different streaming services. This was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Like if you were on Comcast, you'd actually have to pay more to prioritize the Netflix stream. Like we, the consumers, didn't have to. Maybe it was buried in the bill somewhere. But like Netflix was paying Comcast more to prioritize their stream over Hulu. And on another service like Wide Open West or whatever, like Hulu would pay more money to prioritize their stream over Netflix. There was actually a tax on prioritization of packets coming into certain services. Uh-huh. So that was a thing back in the day. So this is why if you were, say, like us watching on TV over Comcast internet, we couldn't get it to work. But if you watch it on AT&T or Verizon, it seemed to work fine with a little buffering. So like that could be a play too. This might not be a Netflix problem. It might be a provider problem.
I'm letting you know, I literally work in app development. It's 100% a Netflix problem. 100%. This is a Netflix problem.
Either way, they screwed the pooch. Oh my gosh. And it gives them an opportunity to fix it before your precious football day.
But here's the thing.
I cared more about this. I don't care about football. I ain't watching it on Christmas Day.
And this is why I agree with Aaron, because on football, if it buffers in the first quarter, I might miss a sack. I might miss a touchdown. I can watch the highlight on ESPN on a different app in like 2 seconds, right? The thing is with a fight, if the thing buffers as Tyson throws the only punch he throws the entire time, and that's the one that's going to knock the dude out,
gosh,
I'm going to miss it because it buffered.
Come on, Amanda. You're acting like this didn't look like the most staged fight in history.
No,
they're literally dancing around. And then afterward, Jake Paul, I didn't want to hurt somebody that didn't need to be hurt. Bitch, you're in a boxing match. Don't fight then. This is why no one takes Jake Paul seriously. This Jake Paul is not a serious boxer. There's nothing about him that is a serious boxer. I don't care. Oh, he's fought this person and that person. Everything he's fought is an exhibition match and it's for show. He can't fight real fighters because real fighters would beat the ever loving shit out of him. He's a goddamn YouTuber.
He did fight one real fighter. He was 25 years old and he lost to him.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, I'm sure. The only fight he really does is against his own dignity because he doesn't have any. He can't fucking fight to save his life. So he's got to do these.
To a Jake Paul hate shit.
I'm just because he put the whole thing together. If you're gonna put this whole thing together, make it work, make it.
The whole thing was stupid.
He put the whole thing together. He set it up. It looked rigged. I hate to say it. Nobody looked like they were really intending on boxing throughout the thing. There's constant hugs. There's love taps. There's what is happening?
I do not want to disrespect the art of dance because dance is amazing. I love dance. I watch So You Think You Can Dance. This was dancing. This was not boxing.
Dancing with the Stars.
And Amanda, I'm surprised you, because you have gone on the record that you do not like boxing. You think it's a vulgar sport.
I do not. Yeah, it is.
So that's why she liked this, because it wasn't boxing.
It literally wasn't. There was not a single moment in that specific fight that made me uncomfortable, but watching the women's match and then the prelim men's match before that,
I was
literally cringing and like squealing and like, oh my God, this is horrid. But I got to their fight and it was not, obviously, it wasn't bad at all. Obviously, it was either staged or Mike really just did not have the capability that he thought he did. And Jake Paul
He had the absolute capability. He stood there and just said, keep punching me. Take your points. I'm collecting a paycheck and going home.
Who knows which way it is? I don't know. I don't really care because realistically, any of them could have some level of staging and script to them. So it is what it is. You have a celebrity who does YouTube videos. What do you guys expect? That's how I feel about it.
The WWE looked more real than this fight did.
It really did. I was waiting for the Rock to come out and throw a freaking chair over.
That would be kind of amazing.
I would have loved it. And then I wouldn't have seen it though because it was buffering. Or is down or anything else. I wouldn't have seen the Rock. Oh, it would have been a pebble in my screen. We should probably move on. Fine. We'll see how football pans out. Hey,
we'll
our show,
see how it goes.
Our show's independently funded. Therefore, all the expenses are from our own pockets because we don't have Jake Paul's money. And Patreon helps fans support the favorite podcast, which we all just gave him. Thanks, Netflix.
Also, did you know that he is the owner or whatever of Celsius? I felt so dirty. I drink one of those every single day and I've just been filling his pockets.
You have. What, you know what he doesn't spend the money on? Moisturizer. Why is he 27 and looks 42? I don't understand what's going on with him. He's got too much money for that. Anyway, now you understand what Patreon is. If you want to support the show, it's patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. We've got a new episode of Bad Movie Night where we talk about the movie Trap. And now we're going to go to our From the Outside In topic. Villain origin stories, or we can talk about Jake Paul's villain origin story when he was a YouTuber and how it's, you know, grown from there. But we won't.
Patreon's kind of like Mike Tyson in a way.
Well, yeah, he's got one too. Yeah, he's got quite a dark history.
Well, you just stand there, people give us money, and we don't really have to do much.
I mean, we were all rooting for the convicted felon. Very recently, we have seen The Penguin. That just finished. And now Wicked, which we're going to talk about shortly. Check your timestamps again. Two very prominent villains receiving detailed, layered origin stories. One is kind of fleshing out why they're such a supervillain. And the other one is saying, maybe they're not such a supervillain. So they're taking like two completely different approaches to the same idea. So I want to talk about villain origin stories. Do we need more of these? And let's start there. Now that we've had a couple, do you guys want to see more of these out in the ether? More of these kinds of stories?
I mean, yeah, because we've already had a few of these. Maleficent most recently comes to mind.
We've had a few. Yep.
Yeah. So it's like, I think these are really an interesting way to tell it because people don't become villains without having some kind of thing happen to them. Right. Mm-hmm. So I really feel like if we want to talk about the exploration of character and the understanding of why people are motivated to do the things that they're doing, like that kind of art is best told through the story of villains. And so like, you know, there are definitely people that are villains, like think Ted Bundy, for example, definitely a horrible person, horrible situation. But No Man of God was a fantastic story to talk about, like the origin of Ted Bundy and how it all worked out and getting into the mind of Ted Bundy. So,
but that's like, that's a real person though. I mean, I'm talking fictional villains, not people with a real
fictional, nonfiction. It doesn't matter. Like understanding the backstory behind why it happened, I think is always fascinating.
I'm always down for more villain origin stories. The only time that I have struggles with seeing more of them is if it's a character I already know, and I feel like it's better not knowing their origin story, that it makes them more mysterious or more interesting and intriguing or whatever. Otherwise, I mean, I love a good villain, so I'm always down to check it out. But it just really depends on how I know the content, if I know it going in or not.
Can you think of somebody off the top of your head? Just like an origin story or a story where you don't want to know more about. Like, I guess in my mind, Darth Vader would be that guy. I didn't need the Anakin backstory. I really liked not knowing that, honestly. I enjoyed that more.
I think it's any time that they're terrifying to you and you just want them to stay that way. So just using a TV show, The Master and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, he's a master vampire. I don't need to know his origin story. Like, I don't need to know all the details of how he grew up and what drove him to be this evil when he became a vampire. You know what I mean? Like they can be just really cool evil characters.
I think I'm coming around to it just because these most recent iterations, right? Wicked and the Penguin, like they really created quality. And I realize Wicked's not new, but they created quality origin stories and really elaborated on what was on the page. The Penguin is not from necessarily strictly from the comic book. Wicked, I never read the book, so it's new to me. You know, those kinds of things where otherwise Maleficent was good. Morbius was terrible. Madam Web, not great. You know, I haven't seen Kraven yet, but I'm leery on that one. You know, when it's done right, when there's care taken, when you have the right people behind it, I think any story can work. And I'm intrigued by things like we're seeing now. I would love to see an expanded story, like take a Thanos, right? Marvel hasn't really done much on screen to kind of elaborate on how Thanos rose to power and all that. That could be very, very interesting to take it from that perspective and see that world and where it goes. You know, that kind of simplicity can really work if you take the time and go into Agatha. That I haven't watched that, but I've heard great things about that show.
I did.
Now,
it was great.
Was that a wonderful villain origin? It's not really an origin story, though. It's right a continuation, or do they really go into her roots?
No, it's a continuation, but you do get to learn a bit about what she went through, what her experiences were, other witches' experiences from different times. So you do get her origin story, but it's based in a following of WandaVision.
Gotcha. But really, what about the idea of limited screen time? Villains that have limited screen time often can impose the greater threat. Now, what I mean by that is if you go back, watch Silence of the Lambs, right? Anthony Hopkins is in that movie, I think 20 minutes, something like that. Absolutely menacing. Carries grossly overrules the actual main villain of the movie and becomes a terrifying threat. Ends up getting a couple more movies. People love the movies, obviously. But he dilutes with every movie. He becomes less menacing with every movie. And by the time you got a prequel, which was Hannibal Rising, Hannibal's the main character the whole time. It's kind of boring. You know, it can be overdone. I think if you're going to do an origin story, much like the Penguin, I think should be, it should be a one and done. It's kind of the concept of limited screen time, but in series or movie terms, just it doesn't need trilogies. It doesn't need, you know, 10 films. Tell the story, get out.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's like,
I think
like,
another good example of that would be Michael Myers in Halloween. You have limited use of him. He's not overwhelming. You don't even really know who he is, but the idea that he could be lurking around a corner is what's menacing.
Yeah,
sometimes it's what you don't see too,
and you do get his origin story, but it's very quick, and that's why, you know, the original Halloween.
Even then, you don't fully understand why he does what he does, even at that age.
Not in the original one. Not until Rob Zombie screwed that up and decided
we're
going to show you why he was such a mad hillbilly kid. Oh my god! So, what makes a great villain before you kind of dive into this? And I've been thinking about this a lot because there's been a lot of focus on villains lately with these properties, Agatha and Wicked and Penguin. And the one thing that always returns to my mind is I need the character to believe they're in the right. If they know they're the bad guy, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work to me. That's not a great villain. That's just the sociopath. I need someone that believes whatever they're doing is for the greater good. Like in their heart, they believe they're doing the right thing. That's important to me. That's a great villain, not just a murderer.
Or driven to that cause based on other people that are actually more villainous.
Sure.
Forcing them to be, in the case of Alphaba, right, in Wicked. She's not a villain. She was made to become a villain. And then in trying to prove her innocence, she just continues to do things that just make it even worse.
Like Michael Scofield.
In a way.
I would agree. I think a lot of it has to do with, do you believe that they feel there's a piece of them that isn't fully evil? You know, if they believe that they're doing something good or right, then that means that there's a chance of hope for them, I think, is even a part of it. but I need them to be entertaining, like sarcastic or funny, or just super cool. Like if they're a complete badass at the same time, it makes them more, they're just more entertaining. So you have to be able to keep it jovial yet serious at times and be able to flex in your dynamic and hit the comedy when we need the comedy, things like that. Like villains are all around people that like are going to bring you, suck you in with their charisma.
I also love when villain is a matter of perspective. You know, by some people's perspective, Jack Bauer is a villain. If you watch that series, especially like the later years, he really does become a villain in many ways. John Wick is a freaking villain. I mean, really, if you look at it from everyone else's perspective, like he's just murdering people. They're just trying to do what they were paid to do. And, you know, John Wick's just killing them all over a dog. I mean, you know, I love when you have a character that you can see from a different set of eyes and you can kind of see their plight, even if they're taking the wrong steps, they're doing the wrong things. You know, every vigilante movie, really, that's the villain. Most of the time, like they're the villain of the movie because they're usually killing people. Now they're not necessarily innocent people, but they're, you know, going back and murdering. Charles Bronson in Death Wish, he's murdering people all the time.
Yeah, but just because you're murdering people doesn't mean you're the villain. It just means you're murdering like, people.
It's some, what do they say in The Dark Knight? You either die a villain or you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And that's essentially what happens with vengeance tales, because you get so consumed with vengeance that you eventually become what you hate.
Right, because the vengeance is the key word. I mean, Deadpool's going around killing people too, but Deadpool's not a villain.
He's not a hero.
No.
You know? I'm just saying, like, I like, if it's going to be a villain, I want some, I love a character with a little bit of depth, you know, something I can get behind, some kind of origin story that makes them relatable, not necessarily enjoyable or good, but just relatable in some way. Like the Penguin is a really great example because he's not a good guy, but they do a lot of things to make it so you empathize with him to some degree, at least in spots of the show. And that's hard to do.
Yeah. Cause if you're like back to the Ted Bundy example, mm-hmm. even though real person, but still it's like during the course of that movie, you're kind of like, I can understand like points of view in some of these stuff. Like I get where he's coming from. It's the fact that you then chose to act on it. That's the bad part. But yeah. You start to go like, oh yeah, I can see that. I can see that.
So
what was that? The Man in the High Castle, mm-hmm. right? Like the Nazis are clearly the villains. Right. We all are in agreement that that was the case in World War II. But yet during the course of that show, you're just sitting there going like, that's a really great ideas. Like, I don't understand why we didn't pick up some of these engineering marvels. And then I'm like, wait a minute, what am I doing? I'm agreeing with the Nazis. Like, come on. Like, those are the types of villains you can get behind as villains.
So speaking of villains, like which ones, any genre, doesn't have to be comic book, by God, like any genre. Do you think would make an example for an awesome series or movie? Like my first one would be Chiwetel Ejiofor from The Operative from Serenity. I would love to know his full story. He's a fascinating character in that movie. I know it's a little seen movie, but Serenity is a movie I love based on Firefly, the show. And his character is basically the one assigned to come retrieve River, who's another character in the movie. And you don't really get much of his backstory, but he seems like a fascinating character. I would love to see that fleshed out in a series or a film of some sort like that. Like, who would you want to see?
The one that I go to, I tried to scope very hard outside of comic books in that whole world.
Okay.
But wanted to go with something that I know I would love to see more of, since it's an expansion or a telling of related to something that I like a lot. And so I went with Vincent Vega from Pulp Fiction.
Ooh.
And this was actually a rumored prequel idea called Double V Vega. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't happen because of timing and some other reasons. But I thought that would be a really fun one because, one, he's such an entertaining character. We still have Travolta alive, so that helps. All of those characters could reunite in some way.
He couldn't play the prequel portion though. he could be the guy reminiscing.
No, but he maybe. Could do, yeah, he could continue and like get a like a little cameo in there. And that's what makes it fun sometimes is when you get to see those characters come back in some other way.
They just show him still dead on the toilet.
Or just like, I don't know, some other points in his life, you know, it doesn't have to be after his death. Sure, but sure. So anyway, I thought that one would be fun. And it's one that has enough name to it that I know it would easily get the buy. Like people would be willing to go see that.
Well, number one, love that. Number two, I couldn't pick one. I was literally going down the line of like Tarantino villains are so good. Like all mm-hmm. of them are so good. I was like, yeah. Hans Landa from Inglourious Basterds. Love to see that. Yep. Jody Domingue. I'd love to see his story. Mr. Blonde, of course. You know, you're going to bark all day or bite. Mm-hmm. Little doggy, are you going to bite? And you've got Marcellus Wallace. Like, what is that story? Like, there's just,
right?
I could name Bill. Frickin' Bill. I'd love to see the full Bill story. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Honestly, all of them.
He needs to shut up with 10 movies and get to writing, just like Ridley Scott said. Shut up and make some movies, man. Love it. Troy, what about you?
I'm going to beat the dead horse, because I know we talked about this last week, probably, if I'm recollecting, but I still want to see the Palpatine origin story. How does Plagueis find him? Why does he?
And somehow he returned. That covered the bases, didn't it?
Well, the thing with Palpatine was that Palpatine was so dark that Plagueis was the one that actually knew how to actually create life and take life away. And so the fact that Palpatine was able to kill Plagueis in order to get that skill, like I want to know like what happened between those two characters to make that happen. Like that seems like an interesting tale. Like how did Palpatine rise up? How did Plagueis find him? What was their, you know, Padawan master Sith Lord combo, like, you know, go through some of those trials and tribulations to the point where Palpatine now is better than the master and takes the master out. Like that'd be a great pinnacle, and it could be one movie. It doesn't have to be three.
Yeah. And everything has to be a trilogy.
Right.
As long as you're doing movies. I just don't want any more Star Wars TV shows.
TV shows.
I can't do it.
But like, that could be a singular 2-hour, 10-minute movie. No Skywalkers, just Palpatine and Plagueis and how they fit into the timeline at that point in time, you know, for them to rise up and be as strong as they were. Because then you get a whole, like, what was happening with the Jedi that they got so strong to begin with, that Plagueis had this capability.
Sure. I'd also love to see an Alonzo Harris prequel. Training Day, Denzel Washington's character from Training Day. Mm. I would really be interested in seeing that whole story. Like, how did he, you know, I would love to see at some point he was a good cop. He meant to do good things. He was trying to help people. And then it just all fell apart. I would love to see that.
That's one of my favorite Denzel roles of all time. So I would love to see.
Well, King Kong ain't got nothing on him, you know?
Who would play the young version, though?
His son, John David Washington. No, he couldn't. I don't think he's tall enough. That's it. Man, can you imagine stepping into Denzel's shoes?
No, I can't. That's why I'm curious if there's anybody you can think of
that Aaron could do Pierre. That. Aaron Pierre. That's who I'm going to say could do it. He was in that recent Netflix movie. And the Underground Railroad. He was in the Underground Railroad.
Is he the guy that was in Rebel Ridge?
Yes, Rebel Ridge.
Okay.
There you go.
And he's in Mufasa.
Yep. He's
got a voice part.
Great actor. He's got a lot of presence. He could do it. Boom. I'd watch that. Watch the hell out of that.
Yeah, that actually sounds good. I like him. I only have one more. That's so fine. Full disclosure, I put all my eggs in these two baskets.
Okay.
So my next one.
Well, Tarantino's ones is going to bring you like 10 movies, really. If you put the work in. If you can get him to work.
If you just could focus on his movies.
Right.
So this character is someone who may seem like not a villain to us as an audience member because he's getting revenge. He's getting justice. But to many, many other people, the majority of people, he is a villain. Vigilantes are villains. Mm-hmm. And so this is V from Vendetta.
Mm.
And because I love that character so much, the story and how the film was shot. I would love to see them do an origin story on V and kind of how everything he went through that got him to that point of getting his revenge in a much more detailed way.
Oh, that's really interesting. There you go. That's something different. I'd watch that.
See, I'm out here trying.
I appreciate you making the effort. That sounds interesting. I would. Yeah. Okay. I'm in.
My second one was kind of random, but I was thinking about Avatar: The Last Airbender, and we start out, you know, 100 years, and then the Avatar disappears, and then they find him 100 years later when Fire Lord Ozai has risen to power. So I think it would be a cool story to find out like what happened during the rise of Fire Lord Ozai, because we kind of get Prince Zuko's backstory a little bit as the series goes along. So trying to do a Prince Zuko story probably isn't as powerful. But a Fire Lord Ozai, how does he grow up and why does he decide that he wants to become this all-powerful thing and take out every single tribe across the four lands, right? So I think that would be an interesting story to tell.
I don't know that series, but I'm sure a lot of people probably agree with you.
Especially because then we get like a bunch of avatars that are before Aang. Like we get to see like those avatars as well, like Kyoshi and I'm totally going to lose my avatar card now because I'm drawing a blank.
Just insert
a Troy, I'm going to have to take your word on this.
Yeah. Insert a blue elf at some point or something.
A blue elf?
A blue elf. Avatar Roku.
That's there you go. Something along those lines. I'd also like to see Top Dollar from The Crow. I would love to see it. It's one of my favorite villains in film. And there's not much to... I mean, yeah, he's basically a criminal overlord, but I want to know how he got to that point just because he's a fascinating character. Like there's this weird dynamic
he's
with
funny.
Him and his whatever she is, and he's funny, he's also terrifying and also in control, and I just kind of want to see how that guy ascends to that level. That's far more interesting to me than another Crow movie. Like I would just rather see Top Dollar's story. I think that could be fabulous, but I wish they would have done it at the time because Michael Wincott could have crushed it, but didn't happen. So anything else before we go on listener thought suggestions?
We could do one on just the Fratellis from the Goonies. Like how did the Fratellis come to become the Fratellis?
Wouldn't they have to be basically a Three Stooges of families?
Kind of, yeah. That's why it'd be kind of fun. It'd be a total comedy, a Three Stooges comedy kind of thing.
Okay, I'm in.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like it.
I would also...
How did the LRV get bullet holes in the side of it? You know, it's like, we know it got shot during the race down the beach, but you know,
that's funny.
How many different getaway cars have the Fratellis used over time and how many blenders did they go through?
That could be funny. That could be fun. I also wanted to see Mr. Joshua from Lethal Weapon. It's another character that I was just enamored with. Gary Busey, best role he's ever played. And just a great character. And I'd love to see like an expansion of that. And you could do that with a younger actor for sure. All right. So listeners made their suggestions. I kind of want to go through some of them because there's some really good ones here. Okay.
There are.
Yeah. So, and we'll say what we think. Do we think this would make a very good movie or series, or is this just nuts? Is it nuts? It's possible that it's just nuts. So first up, we've got what happened, Marcus Shelton, what happened in the Gruber household that both brothers grew up to become greedy, terroristic, thieving masterminds. God, that's a...
Marcus, yes.
Would love that. Would absolutely... And I like that he remembers that there were two Grubers in that series, not just Hans. And it's not Hans and Franz. There's two Grubers.
You must watch it every Christmas.
Well, who doesn't, right?
The name of the movie is Growing Up Gruber.
Why not? Yeah, why not? I mean, they're two... great villains. I think Jeremy Irons is kind of unappreciated as Simon and Die Hard with a Vengeance. But just getting that backstory as to that family, I would love to see that. I think that's a great call. Adam Smith, it's definitely way too late and would never happen because of the whole Kevin Spacey situation. But I would have loved to seen a movie about how Kaiser Soze from The Usual Suspects rose to power. Love that idea. And it doesn't matter about Kevin Spacey because it wouldn't be played by him.
Right. Anybody could play him now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would love that. Absolutely love it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I liked Alex's. Alex said, big 24 fan, always thought it would be interesting to see a prequel on Nina Myers and what turned her against the country.
Now, would you want that as a show or like a Hulu movie? What would you want?
I think it's probably a Hulu movie.
It would be hard to do because Jack Bauer would have to be part of it, I would think, because he seemed they were kind of interconnected in many ways from their past.
Well, and she was there from all the way through the third season is when she finally parts from the show, if I remember correctly. Start of the third season.
Yes.
Yeah.
Parts from the show is a nice way of putting it. Yeah.
I didn't want to spoil it or anybody, you know.
It's literally like 20 years old. It's okay. It's going to be all right.
Yeah. So you don't have to like retell obviously season 1, 2, and 3, but no. Getting up to that point, like Kiefer would have to show up at some point towards the end of whatever movie, TV show run it would be. But Nina Myers is a great character. So it'd be interesting to see her rise and how she got converted and whatnot.
I don't know this at all.
Fair enough. Reese Bennett, since they're bringing Highlander back, maybe one on the Kurgan to see what made him such a bastard.
Which one?
The Kurgan, the villain from Highlander. You've probably never seen Highlander, but there can only be one. So,
she missed that one.
Yeah. Well, people that have seen the movie understood that joke. I would watch that. I sure would.
It'd be okay.
Yeah.
Chris actually said something about the Q from Star Trek. First introduced in The Next Generation, like a whole series on Q itself. What is the Q? How did the Q get created? Where did the Q come from?
Give the people what they want.
Who is
Troy?
The Q?
Well, nobody knows what the Q is. It's just represented by John DeLancey's character in Next Generation.
Oh.
And the only reason Q works is because John DeLancey was so freaking good in the role. So, like, I don't know if you can do anything about the Q without John DeLancey being part of it.
Fascinating. Ronnie Godchill. I'm old school. I'd like to learn more about the Goblin King from Labyrinth. That would be cool.
Oh, that would be cool.
That would be very cool. I'd also, man, this is right up your alley. I'd also love to see a Harry Potter series from back when Snape was young and growing up. Wouldn't that mean he'd be in love with Harry's mom and stuff? Like you get that whole love triangle? Yeah.
Because you wouldn't need him to be in it. Like younger, there would be a younger version playing him. So I that sounds good. I like it.
Yeah, like Snipes years going through Hogwarts.
Snipes years?
Yeah.
Snape's years?
Snipe.
Well, Snipes is
Severus
Blade.
Snipe.
Wesley Snipes plays Blade. And it's right. A different guy that plays Snape. Just to clarify.
But like that idea.
Would you watch it though? You're a diehard Harry Potter fan. Do you want that? Versus this whole series that's going through the whole thing all over again.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would prefer that much more.
And I'd watch that versus like a Voldemort backstory.
Didn't we already get that in the movies? We kind of got his whole
backstory. You get a little bit of the backstory, but not like a full-on deep dive, but you get points of view of it.
Yeah, not like a dedicated.
He's not a very empathetic villain. Like, I don't know how you would get in, how you would approach him.
No, that's evil just for evil.
Yeah.
That's like the villain. That's what I'm saying. You have to be likable. He's not likable.
No, and he needs a nose job.
It's just evil.
But Tom might have been likable, and that's the story you have to tell us. Why did Tom
exactly
become evil?
Did Snape know him as a kid? Could they tie the two together? Tom Riddle
Yes.
Snape?
Potentially.
Okay. Ruthie Rink. This is the last one. We can move on to Wicked. We're close to Wicked. Normally, I am not super into villains. I don't really care about them so long as they are a great foil for the hero. However, since I just binged all of Justified, great series, I would say Boyd Crowder, but only so long as he is played by Walton Goggins, because I can't imagine anyone else doing that character right. Two things. One, don't want a prequel because only a villain origin story, because only Walton Goggins can play that character as far as I'm concerned, and he can't do younger. His hairline won't allow it. Now, to the second part, I would love to see a Boyd Crowder series and just leave Raylan out of it. I would watch that.
I would.
I'd like it with Raylan, but I would watch.
Yeah, I agree.
Just saying.
But I really would prefer it with Raylan. Like for reference, if anybody is listening, please know.
Make that happen. Would you would you watch, like, if they did do like a Boyd Crowder before him, without him, would you watch it?
I probably would. But the actors would have to be pretty great.
Yeah, because he made that a performance worth watching, really. I mean, he made the character more than the character made him. You know what I mean?
Because young him is pretty awful, like pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a hard one to root for anyway.
Yeah, he's just like a raging racist and everything else.
Yeah,
right?
Who wants that?
Nobody. Don't need that anymore. We need lighter villains. happier, more pleasant, politically correct villains. That's what we need. Get this shit together. Well, you know what? We're going to go talk about some movies. Amanda's going to head out of here, but now it's time to... So Amanda, say bye.
Bye, Amanda.
Thanks, y'all, for having me for another week as your special guest.
Thanks for being here. Now let's get into... We're going to do a couple discussions. We're going to talk about Cross and Armor, and then we're getting into Wicked, spoiler-free and spoilery, so hold tight. All right, so Amanda's out of here because she hasn't seen Wicked or anything else, apparently. I don't know what the hell she's doing on a movie and TV podcast, but... Let's.
She's only here because our John had the week off. That's the only reason.
Just kidding. She really does want to see Wicked. So let's move into Armor.
Armor is a father and son working as security guards for an armored truck company. They encounter a team of would-be robbers while on a bridge. They become trapped and must come up with a plan to escape and ensure their survival. It stars Jason Patrick and Sylvester Stallone, and it's directed by Justin Root.
Mm-hmm.
Route.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Comes out the 22nd when you listen to this.
Ooh, that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So these people, like, what are they playing? Like, what is the deal here? Is this like, you know, literally on a bridge the entire movie?
Yeah. Well, yeah, kind of. It's like Phone Booth, but in an armored car.
I'm actually in on that. I really like Phone Booth.
Okay. All right. Fair enough then. Fair enough. So here's the deal. So Jason Patrick, plays James, who's an alcoholic father. He hides his alcoholism. His wife was killed in a tragic car accident. He blames himself. So he goes to AA still, but he's actually, you know, lying to everyone else. He's really still an alcoholic. And his son, Casey, is played by Josh Wiggins. They do this route together. They run the armored truck together. So they're en route on their delivery, etc. When they get hijacked, basically forced off the road and onto this abandoned bridge by Rook, who's Sylvester Stallone, and his team, and they're determined to get something. It's a MacGuffin inside the armored car. And what happens is they finagle their way into the back of the armored car and lock it up securely. And so it becomes a cat and mouse thriller, if you will, of Sylvester Stallone trying to get into the truck or force Jason Patrick's James to come out of the truck. That's the movie. And yeah, it almost all exclusively takes place on that bridge.
So they're like in the truck, out of the truck, in the truck, out of the truck. Like who? Like
no, they're
fighting. Who's fighting who?
They're in the truck most of the time. There's a lot of talky. There are a few valiant attempts at trying to get them out of the truck and force them out via various ways. I don't want to spoil it for anyone. It's an hour and a half movie, but it's really about an hour and 15 minutes because the opening credits are about 10 minutes long and the end credits are about five. So it's a very short movie and the plot is shorter. Yeah. That's the plot.
Is it action packed? I mean, is there like gunfire? Is there like, they like roll like shit underneath the truck or something to try to get it to blow up? I mean, like is there anything exciting?
No, there's some action, and don't get me wrong. Stallone is Stallone. Like whenever he's doing his thing, he's commanding the screen. And I think Jason Patrick actually he's trying to keep it interesting. He's trying to give pathos to this character, James, and he's trying to keep the audience engaged. You know, and a lot of it is his coming to grips with his own personal demons with his son, who just wants to have a life with his dad and get past the death of his mom and James's wife. There's good elements here. It's not action-packed. There is some action, but it's very intermittent. It's much more a slow burn thriller, if you will, but really with a large helping of family dynamics, if you will. So no, it's much more dialogue heavy than action-packed.
So it's more along the lines of something's in the car that they need, or is the thing that they need in the car that they need not actually a thing, and it's actually more family dynamic and it's like a hostage situation, or
it's a MacGuffin. It doesn't matter what the thing is. It's one of those deals. It's just a matter of they need said thing, which they have inside the armored car. Now, they also only have a limited amount of time because Casey, the son, is injured during the attempted robbery. So it's a matter of, well, what's dad going to do to get him out of this alive?
Got it. Yeah. So they're not even worried about what's in the car. He wants to save his son, but he also doesn't want to lose the thing.
He's afraid if he gives them the thing, they're going to kill them instantly. Right. Yeah, it's one of those.
All right. Doesn't sound very exciting. So if $10 is full price of mission, what are you giving?
I mean, it's got Stallone. You'd think it automatically got like an 8 out of me, right? But it does not. I like Jason Patrick. I think he's really trying to elevate the film. Love Stallone. You can tell he worked for one day on this movie. This is not something he put a lot of time into. The plot is very thin. The dialogue is very thin. The plot is very thin. The surrounding heist team that Stallone has is very thin. There's nothing memorable about any of them. The ending is extremely clunky and makes no sense. So 4.5 out of 10.
Oof, 4.5.
Yeah. And that's almost exclusively Stallone and Patrick that get the 4.5.
2 points each.
And 2.25.
And a half point because the armored car is cool.
There you go. There you go. Whatever works. Now, before we get to Wicked, any recent film or TV recommendation you want to talk about? You don't have anything, but I do.
Well, I did watch the Silo premiere, Silo season 2 premiere. Unfortunately, everything that was in the Silo season 2 premiere was pretty much in the trailers for Silo season 2. So nothing really shocking or exciting, unfortunately. So
that's too bad.
But they do end on a pretty good cliffhanger at the end of the episode. So episode 2 will be much more interesting. I'm excited.
So this is one where you love the first season, and this is about people that are trapped in an underground silo, right? And they don't know why?
Correct.
Okay. So do they still not know why when season 2 starts?
I mean, they know why they're in the silo because the outside isn't like bad, not breathable.
Sure.
They can actually see outside, and they can see that it's like a desolate nuclear wasteland. So they know why they're in there, but people obviously, you know, you get stir crazy. And if they say the words like, I want to go outside, the creed, the motto, the pact, the constitution, whatever, basically says, if anybody says they want to go outside, you got to let them.
And let them fend for themselves, right?
Exactly. Which they basically get like 10 steps. They wipe off the camera because they have to clean the camera if they go outside, and then they walk 5 more steps and they die every time.
Well, they could find, you know, that girl from Fallout or Clark from 100. Maybe one of them are walking around out there.
Oh, Clark definitely would be.
That's funny. Okay, so another what I've been watching, brand new, Amazon Prime, whole series is on. I actually started to review it, and I did not get to where I could review it properly before last week's episode. But Cross, okay? It's a new series version of Alex Cross, which has been played on film multiple times, once by Morgan Freeman in Long Came a Spider and Kiss the Girls, once in the, I think it was called Alex Cross, where you had Tyler Perry playing Alex Cross, which I actually like. I liked all three of those movies. I have no problem with anyone. But here we have Aldous Hodge. You and I love Aldous Hodge.
Aldous Hodge is awesome.
Yeah, Aldous Hodge is awesome. And he was in Leverage. If you've never seen Leverage, he was also in Hawkman and Black Adam a couple of years back. He's just an actor that can be dramatic, fun. He can do action. He can do anything. He literally can do anything. He's just a very charming, talented guy. And his muscles have abs now. Like, he has worked out so much since the Leverage days. He is ready for whatever superhero role Hollywood would like to throw at him.
That he definitely is.
Oh, man. So good. I love...
He could throw the role at them, technically, because he's that strong.
He is. Man. Good call. Well, this is based on James Patterson's Alex Cross novels, right? And Alex Cross is a forensic psychologist who is also a police officer, and he uses psychology to kind of get into the killer's minds. And this is very much a wonderful cast. You have Isaiah Mustafa in here as his partner, John. You have someone you might recall, Ryan Eggold, is playing Ed Ramsey, who's a rich, entitled SOB as part of the cast. You know, Tom Gunn.
So your feelings on him haven't changed?
Yeah. Pretty much playing the exact same character from Blacklist. It's a pretty stacked cast. Everybody knows their parts, and they're doing really well with the job. And what it is they have a serial killer that seems to be emulating other serial killers, and it's Cross is trying to put those things together while also dealing with someone is stalking him personally and trying to put those pieces together. So there's a lot of that variance of ideas, and it's really about him just trying to figure out who the killer is. And It's 8 episodes. It's very much, it's kind of like Amazon Prime really has this lock on dominant alpha male characters, right? You've got the Reacher, you've got Jack Ryan, you've got Cross, you know,
Bosch.
Yeah. I mean, they just have a plethora of alpha males and they seem to be like, that's their wheelhouse now. That's what they do best. And I would add this to the list. There's a couple things where I stumble. I do think some of the, not the music, not the soundtrack, so to speak, but the actual score is a little weak and kind of clunky, feels a little generic. But overall, I mean, the story really becomes engaging. I'm really like involved, and Aldous Hodge really makes the character his own. And by the end of the series, you really can't wait to see where season 2 is going to go, because it already has been renewed for season 2. So, you know, you're getting 2 seasons out of it. And it's resolved. So it's a 1 season arc. It's just like Reacher. Like, everything gets resolved by the end. Really enjoyed it. Really recommend it. I really hope people check it out, make it a big hit, because this guy has been like almost popping 1,000 times and just never seems to cross the line for whatever reason. He deserves to be a star. He's that good.
Yeah, as a lead, right?
Yes.
He's great supporting everywhere, but he's never had that like one thing that's going to put him over the top.
No. And in fact, in Leverage Redemption, which is like the revamped version of Leverage, he has gracefully popped in on multiple episodes. Keep in mind, he doesn't need to do, like, his career is elevated past Leverage, but he still comes back because he respects those guys and he loves those guys. So he comes back and he'll do a couple episodes a season. Every time he's back, the show is instantly what it should be. Like, he makes it better. He just makes things better.
I had a joke. I'm not going to use it. It's so bad.
Okay. I'm glad. we'll move past. So now we can get to get a little wicked. Now, here's what we're going to do. We're going to just briefly share our overall thoughts on the movie in a spoiler-free fashion. Then we're going to talk about it spoilery, because millions of people have seen the musical. Millions of people will have seen the movie by the time they listen to this, probably. So we want to... And Troy is a huge fan of the musical, so we want to have like an open discussion.
And my wife is a huge fan of the books.
There you go. See?
Yeah.
She's not here, but you can cover her base. So Elphaba is a misunderstood young woman.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
What would I say wrong?
Whoa, whoa.
Elphaba.
Whoa.
Elphaba.
Whoa.
Elphaba.
Whoa.
Elphaba. Elphaba. My bad. Not a big fan of the musical, the books, or anything else for that matter.
She's not a Mexican cartel witch. El Chapa, Elphaba.
Elphaba is a misunderstood young woman because of her green skin, and Glinda, a popular girl, becomes friends at Shiz University in the Land of Oz. After an encounter with the wonderful Wizard of Oz, their friendship reaches a crossroads. And just so you know, for anyone that wasn't aware, this is a part 1 of 2. The second part comes out next Christmas. So you will get kind of a cliffhanger, but I think it ends at a really good spot, so to speak.
Yeah, it is a completely contained story.
It works. Yeah, it works as a contained story. It stars Cynthia Erivo, Ariana Grande, Jeff Goldblum. It was directed by John Chu. And just for people that are Wizard of Oz fans, the movie kind of opens in that element of where the Wizard of Oz is in a place and time, and then it kind of rolls back and gives you the story. So you do get a little taste of Oz of that, you know, before we roll back in time. Now, Troy, before we get into spoilers, spoiler-free overview thoughts.
Yeah, the biggest thing was I was afraid of how they were going to do this, because the musical that's been out for 25 years or more, 2 hours, 32 minutes, I do believe. This part 1 is the first act before intermission of the musical. And they do have some additional book information in this particular production to basically stretch it out to 2 hours and 40 minutes plus. And I'm just like, how are you going to put a 2.5 hour show into a 4, 5 hour and 20 minute movie between the two parts? If it's even two parts, because there's technically 4 books. It was great. It was amazing. Everything was just firing on all cylinders. The biggest thing that I think that movie musicals tend to have a struggle with is when they give you dialogue and they're like, la, 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 talk, 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 talk. There's a pause and then the music starts. Wicked does a really great job of letting the dialogue roll right into the music.
Yeah, I agree with
that. In such a way that it's almost seamless. And I think that really sets it apart from other movie musical adaptations. I'm thinking like In the Heights, most recently, or La La Land, even though La La Land is fantastic. The overall story was everything that I expected. I didn't find anything missing. I didn't have any songs that were missing. So for me, it was really, 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 really blew my socks off because I was expecting a lot worse, to be honest. Because I'm like, how are they going to do this? But they did it, and it's freaking amazing.
And your score? $10 for Bryce's Mission?
I keep going back and forth because I don't want to give it as high of a score as I want to give it because I'm also like uber fan. So I'm trying
give
to like
what you want, man.
I'm trying to bring my uber fanness down, but I'm still sitting at a 9.5.
Love that. Love that. You're a big fan. There's nothing wrong with that.
It's such a great story, first and foremost. Like the origin story of Elphaba before Dorothy ever shows up. Like, it's a great story, first and foremost. And then what they did with it and how the music comes into it and everything. And Ariana Grande, oh my, she just slays this role. Like, I was like never a big Ariana Grande fan before. And I thought her in this role looked weird when I saw the trailer the first time. But once you see the movie, you're like, Ariana Grande can do no wrong.
Or Ariana.
Grande. Ariana. I don't know.
At least my flub was a fictional character. Okay.
Sure.
Fictional character. And I'm going to call her Elfie.
Sure. From now just on. Make it easy on yourself.
I might.
I'm just going to call her G. G.
G. G. G. G. So my thoughts are kind of similar. I never saw the musical. My one major issue different from you is I did not love the songs. I didn't find the songs particularly memorable. It isn't like Greatest Showman or La La Land, like what you talked about. In the Heights, those were all perfect examples of musicals where I went and I was like singing them all the way home. Like I just wanted the soundtrack right away. I didn't have this with this particular movie. I found one song very good, popular, and Gravity are probably the two that I really enjoyed. That said, even though I didn't love the music, I love the musicality of the performances, the set pieces, the design, the choreography, because it really does come together in a rather flawless fashion. I was extremely impressed with how everything flowed, which, I mean, really, really did surprise me in a lot of ways, but not so much in terms of the choreography, because John Chu did do In the Heights. He was the director on that one, and that had a very similar
look and flow, feel.
Musicality, yeah. Right? And a very similar approach, and it definitely comes through here. Like he is made for adapting musicals to film. He really understands how to make it cinematic as well as respect the source material. He brings it to another medium. Does a great job with that. But again, the songs are my biggest setback. What I love about it, and I can't rave enough. What's funny is Cynthia Erivo didn't blow me away because she always impresses me. She's just one of the best actresses working today, in my opinion. She doesn't get nearly enough credit, but she's a fantastic actress. She kills it in every single thing she does. Go watch The Outsider. Go watch Harriet. Go watch anything she does. She kills it. She's fantastic. What shocked me is Ariana Grande, because I walked into this not wanting to see her. I'm not a fan of her music. I think she's exhausting because she's everywhere. Not because of anything she's done. She has that kind of, I don't know, Glinda persona a little bit. And I just find it a little grating. It doesn't do anything for me. I'm just kind of like, okay, whatever.
Maybe that's why it works, because
personality. I think it works because I came to appreciate that she is phenomenally talented through the movie. The movie, they really, like, they do not let her off light. She's not just singing. She's not just, like, she has comedic timing. She has dramatic timing. She has personality. She commands the screen. All of these things I did not know or expect from her. And I guess I should. She's a megastar. I get other people love her. I don't. But I now really respect her, and I really appreciate her, and think she was born to play Glinda. Like, she's that good. She blew me away. And then there's Jonathan Bailey, who plays Fiero. To put it into perspective, I didn't know this dude at all. I'm sure I've seen him in things before, but there's so many actors these days. He was extremely charismatic, really carried the screen when he was on, reminded me very much of Chris Pine.
Yep. Chris Pine Into the Woods, or Chris you. Pine That's Dungeons what I was and Dragons.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Completely. Like if you would have said this is Chris Pine young, I would have been like, oh wow, the AI is amazing. Because it very much came across like this is Chris Pine. So the performances all won me over. And I went to see this with my mother, who she when I was a kid, to give you personal insight in case you care, but when we were kids, I had to watch Wizard of Oz once a year with my mom because it used to come on TV once a year. And it was like great family time for us. So this was very much a son-mother date night. And she had never seen the musical, but she wanted to see it on film and on screen, and she absolutely loved it. And it really brought back a lot of those kinds of memories about why we had such a good time watching it together when I was younger and yada, yada, yada. So there's definitely a personal connection, which I think a lot of other people who are fans of the film, the original film, are going to feel if they haven't seen the musical. And people that love the musical, I think, are going to love this. So if $10 before my submission, I actually am going to up it to about $8.50. I had it at around $7.50. Whoa. But I think because of, on hindsight, I was dinging it mostly because I don't like the music. Fine. But I really enjoyed the production value, the story, the performances were great. And Ariana Grande won me over, which is hard to do because I'm not joking when I say I was not looking forward to that part.
And she won me over. Nor was I.
Yeah. So there you go. Those are our spoiler-free thoughts. Now we're going to go into spoilers. If you have not seen the film and you want to continue being spoiler-free until you see it, come back to this episode and we'll talk then. But right now, spoilers are on. So you've been warned. This is on you if you listen past this point. Okay, you saw the musical on Broadway, right? Proper, correct?
I saw the music literally on Broadway at the Gershwin, the original home.
So you saw it with Chenoweth and...
No, I saw it very, very late. I only saw it 2 years ago for the first time live.
So what do you think in terms of the music as it's been adapted? Because you saw it on... I assume there's a difference since they stretched this out to some degree. I don't know how much is different. But in terms of the musical, which stops at Act 1, this movie does.
Correct. Comparing it to the musical, yes, stops at Act 1.
How does it compare for you?
I mean, Act 1 of the musical is fantastic. Act 2, it's a little bit slower, a little bit more of the story fleshes out, a little bit more talky-talky than the music itself. So, you know, from that perspective, if you're going to take Act 1 and put it into a movie form, it's going to be fantastic, because the first act is literally, these are the characters, this is how we sing, this is how we move, this is how we dance, this is how we go about our world. But it's just like it was so good in comparison, because I'm like, the entire time I never looked at my watch, and the only time I looked at my watch was because I'm like, there's a lot to go yet in the first act, like how close are we to the end, because I'm just curious, like how close are we to what the 2-hour, 40-minute runtime was. That was the only reason I looked at my watch, was to see like, how are they going to wrap this up? Because there was just so much more to go. And I was surprised how much they were to cram in to a 2-hour and 40-minute that really isn't part of the musical. Just expanding the dialogue and expanding the relationship between Elphaba and Glinda, and you know, their time in the room together, and you know, the other characters that are surrounding them, and getting them some time that you don't really get to see on stage because they're there, but they're just in the background. So to get some of that interaction, I think was really great. The piece with the animals and how the animals are being affected in Oz, and how they're going from being able to talk to not being able to talk. I mean, that's like not really more until like the second part of the movie. So the fact that they brought some of that up front enough that it gave you a reason to come back for the second movie, I think is a really good move on their part. So yeah, there's a lot of really good, really good in this first part.
And the music is pretty much the same. I mean, did you feel better or worse like with the songs? Did you enjoy them more here or on Broadway?
No, the Broadway one is hard, right? Because whenever you listen to it, you're listening to Kristen Chenoweth as Glinda and Idina Menzel as Elphaba. So like stalwarts of musical caliber, right? You know, if you listen to a modern recording or modern cast, still really great, but you'll always are going to hear Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel whenever you think of, you know, Gravity especially, right? Mm-hmm. Or Popular. those two big numbers. So listening to this, like if I closed my eyes, like there are parts where it sounds like them. Like that's how good Ariana Grande and Cynthia Herrera were. If you close your eyes, there are parts where it sounds like them. Then we had to stretch notes in order to make the stepping work, or we had to stretch notes in order to make the transition to another shot work. Some of those things I think worked. I think a couple of those didn't work. And that was the only reason I gave it a 9.5. Was I have like two very specific ones in the song pacing that took me out of the song.
Do you remember exactly where they were?
Yes. One was in Popular. At the end of Popular, Elphaba leaves down the hallway and Glinda is following her. And then, you know, as she turns around and she does like the la, la.
Yeah, that wasn't part of the song then.
And then she does it again. La, la. And she does it again. La. And like the third time I was like, okay, Ariana Grande, we see you.
Could you remember she has an N in her first name?
Ariana Grande.
He said Ari. Aria? Aria. Aria.
Yeah, Ariana.
Okay. So yeah, so that wasn't really, that was her showing off, is what you're
trying to say. Showing off.
Okay.
Yeah. Like the minute that happened, I was like, oh, that's a show off spot. Yeah. Like it just, the music is built for a way for the orchestra to play it a certain way. And it is supposed to just move into the completion and be done. And those two extra riffs were just like, yeah, no, didn't need that. Good try. The other is right at the end of the movie when you get the big final note, the right, and she's up in the air, mm-hmm. and she's facing you, like in the musical, right? Obviously you have the stage, you only have so much to work with, so she, and in the stage production, she's literally up in the air facing the audience, and then boom, curtain drops.
Should have, right? Ended right there in the movie. Should have
ended right there. Yep. But they like pause it, drum roll, she swoops down, she flies past the people, the monkeys are chasing her, and then she like bolts off like a torpedo in some really bad CGI towards the sunset. And then it finishes the song.
Yeah,
and
she
like,
totally went Man of Steel on that moment. Yeah.
Totally Man of Steel. It was a total Zack Snyder moment.
it really was. And I think
that part of it just kind of was like, missed the mark. Mm-hmm. Just missed the mark by 2 freaking seconds.
I was literally ready to raise a fist, and then they continued it. And I'm just one of those people where I've had this happen. You know, I've talked about Lord of the Rings, right? Where I stopped
exactly
when they bow.
That's exactly what I thought.
That's exactly what I am just one of those people. As soon as that moment passes, I'm like, you lost it. You had the moment. You lost it.
You had the moment. Yep. It was perfectly beautiful, and it could have just cut to black. She's literally like a giant in this shot, right?
It's fantastic
shot. The black flowing cape down is so black and dark in that moment. Like cutting from black to black would have been such a artistic statement. But no, we had to be cute.
Mm-hmm. Kind of ruined it a little bit.
It ruined it a little bit, yeah. Because it elongates the song that doesn't need to be elongated.
No,
the song
I
is the character, not her, you know, in that moment. The song is like the emotional weight of what you're, you know, going through. And if you... Songs are math. Like music is math. If you mess with the math, it messes with your brain. Mm. And that totally messes with the brain when you do that.
I like that. You can tell John Chu got to that point, and I feel like he just thought, I'm going to add a little something extra cinematic here. Like I'm going to spice it up. I'm going to do something different than what was on the stage. I'm like, no, man, even I have never seen the musical. I know that shot, right? I know that stage shot. I've seen it in ads and trades and whatnot. And I just, once that it was a perfect cinematic shot, and they continued, and I'm like, God damn it. Why can't Hollywood stop doing that? Just trust that this works where it is. But you know,
there's a reason why it's called the downbeat. It's like, boom, cut to black.
Would have been perfect. My only problem with the music, I mean, I said I didn't love the songs. The first song she sings when she's kind of gloating that the Wicked Witch is dead, and she's singing around the Munchkins and whatnot, I couldn't understand.
You couldn't understand a thing she said.
I couldn't understand. So it's not just me. I could not understand a word.
No, her range was so high, and there's so much chorus background that you don't exactly know like what her part is. Is she riffing? Is she just okay? La, 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 or she actually got words? Oof. Like I could not tell.
Good. Glad it wasn't just me then.
And I was kind of like, okay, like this is like one bad thing, like, oh no, here we go, this is where it's going to fall apart. But like the opening is so great, right? The Wicked and Wished is dead, you know, and the whole thing, and the mm-hmm. chorus, and then the choreography, and they're going around from the little munchkin houses to munchkin houses, and they're passing stuff off, and they got the chorus people are coming in on the different parts. Like the choreography and the cinematic of it all as the camera's panning around, freaking fantastic. It was, that opening number is so good. Like it almost puts the stage version to like shame, because you can't get that many people on the stage.
Well, that leads me to my next question. Set design. Now, obviously, the sets are much better for a $100+ million movie.
For sure.
And a stage musical, even though it is a very fancy musical. But I got to say, I was pretty amazed at how well constructed everything was. I felt like I was part of Shiz University. I felt like it was a real place. You know, and I always love when that happens. I didn't love the Harry Potter movies, but I always felt like I'm in Hogwarts. You know what I mean? And that's what this made me feel like. It very much felt like a lived-in, real place that made sense to me.
Yes, I felt like it was a location, like an actual place that they retrofitted and built stuff around.
Yeah, that we could visit.
That versus like building the whole set from scratch. And honestly, that's the thing. I can't tell. I don't know if it was completely built from scratch for the entire thing, or if it actually was like on location and they built around stuff that already existed, like the river and the bridge over the river and things of that nature. This was like maybe like some castle somewhere that they retrofitted, or I mean, it looks that good that you think that this place literally exists.
Yeah, I think most of, you know, the best thing you can say about CGI when there is CGI is that when it blends, you shouldn't notice it. You shouldn't pay Correct. Attention to it. You should feel. So I can't tell where the set ends and where the, you know, CGI design continues. That's always a compliment. Doesn't happen enough. The monkeys, probably the only time where I'm like, eh. They weren't the best. See,
the monkeys I didn't have a problem with.
Okay. What did you have a problem with?
Mine was more like the little hummingbirds. Like they were so like 3D-ish for not being in a 3D movie that you could tell.
It is in 3D. If you can see it in 3D.
Yeah. But it's like the hummingbirds, some of the animals, things that technically wouldn't necessarily be more realistic. Mm-hmm. I think the monkeys get more of a pass because you've seen the flying monkeys before when you watch Wizard of Oz. So it's like your brain, I think, goes to a place that's like, I've seen that before, so then I can compensate, versus like the talking goat and, you know, a few of the other animals like that, just kind of like, that CGI is a little janky there.
I like the goat, and I like
the goat's great.
Yeah. I what I don't like, you know, I wish Hollywood would stop doing this. When you have, okay, you've got a side character like that, where we're supposed to take very seriously, right?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I think Peter Dinklage does a good job. He's a great actor. I have no problem with Dinklage. I wish Hollywood would stop using actors we know, because it is always distracting, unless it's a comedic role where you're just trying to get easy laughs. So Jack Black, Eddie Murphy, things like that. Eddie Murphy's donkey in a live action Shrek or whatever. Okay. But if you're doing something where we're supposed to be immersed into this goat's plight for animal rights, I don't want to be distracted going, where do I know that voice? That's Peter Dinklage, right? And then I hear Peter Dinklage, I no longer see the goat. You know what I mean? That's Hollywood does that too much, and it annoys me.
I mean, I didn't know it was Dinklage until I looked it up afterwards. I mean, I was like, it sounds like Dinklage, but I'm so used to knowing who that character is from the musical and the books that I'm just kind of like, I didn't really listen for Dinklage. I was just, how are they going to do the character? What's the CGI going to look like? How are they going to make this work? You know, does it work? And I was thinking more about that than trying to like make out the voice.
Okay.
But then I was like, it really sounded like Dinklage. So I went and looked it up on IMDb after the credits started rolling. And I was like, oh, it was. Okay.
Well, I want to be immersed in my goat lore. So next time, use somebody else. All right. Just use Joe Average. There's a lot of actors that would love a role like that. To showcase your talents.
Your point is taken, because I remember Aladdin, live action Aladdin, and then Will Smith becomes the genie, and you're just like, no, I don't see the genie. I just see Will Smith.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. Now, when it comes to the casting, we've talked about a few of them. We can continue to talk to them, but we didn't mention Jeff Goldblum as the wizard. Michelle Yao as Madame Morrible. I like the name. Did anything else stand out? I guess let's talk about Cynthia Erivo. She really, really imbues Elfie, just so I don't mess her name up, with every the full gamut of emotion, right? And her relationship with Nessa Rose, mm-hmm. Marissa
Bode. Her sister.
Yeah. Yep. I think that's a beautiful situation because, you know, you kind of understand where both people come from. You get the whole plight of how she feels responsible for her condition, her, you know, being in a wheelchair and whatnot. Like, I've been a big fan of hers as an actress for a long time. It's nice to see her finally get something huge like this, like a real star-making role. And I think she blew the doors off because by the end, you need to still see her as she can become the Wicked Witch. And I think you can see that.
Yeah. She had the Wicked Witch mentality even when she was a child.
That cackle. The cackle she has on there too.
Yeah. I mean, when she like does the whole magic and throws the stones at the kids, when she's, you know, all of that, just that, you know, anger she's been holding back all this time about getting made fun of constantly. You know, she kind of buries it down a little bit and tries to overcome it as she gets older because she doesn't understand these powers. But then when she finally comes into her own and she realizes that she can read the book and do the things that people are afraid of her to do, like that's the part where she just kind of comes into this powerful being of like, don't mess with me because I can totally take your ass down. And she just imbues that, especially in that final shot when she's up in the air.
Hmm. Never ceases to impress me. Now, I don't know where it's going from here, but I assume we're going to see more of her descent into the Wicked Witch of the West.
I mean, I don't want to spoil anything for a second movie.
Is it a fair assumption?
I mean, there you can understand based on the end of the first movie that certain people are not necessarily villains. People make you to be a villain.
Hmm. I do like that this movie's basically saying, nah, see, you're looking at Wizard of Oz all wrong. She was actually the hero the whole time.
That's actually exactly kind of how the second half plays out.
Interesting. Very interesting. So we talked about Ariana Grande. We talked about Cynthia Erivo. What about Jeff Goldblum as the wizard? He doesn't have a very big role here.
But I thought it was really charming, to be honest. When we first hear about how Elphaba comes to be, you know, her mom is basically having an affair with the wizard and the wizard's feeding her this green elixir alcohol and he's drinking the green elixir alcohol and that's why she comes out green from the womb. Mm. At that moment, during that sequence early in the movie, I thought, wow, this really would have been great for Hugh Jackman to be in this.
Oh my God. That would have been so good. Heart going.
So good. And that whole sequence, I was like, this screams Hugh Jackman, Greatest Showman kind of vibe in that, you know, sequence when he's, you know, having the affair. Mm-hmm. But then when it comes to be the wizard later on, I'm like, you know, and Jeff comes out, it's kind of like, oh, you know, you're not like weird Jeff Goldblum.
You might have just tipped your hat to a spoiler. I made that assumption. I don't think they said it in the movie, though.
What, that it was the wizard?
Yeah, that her mom checked up with the wizard. I think it was implied by, for
it's
sure.
Implied.
Yeah.
It's implied.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what I said. I'm like, oh, so her dad is the wizard and he doesn't know yet.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then when Jeff comes out, I'm kind of like, okay, you're not weird Jeff. You're not like Jurassic Park Jeff. You're not like, you know, hey, whatever, you kind of Jeff. You know, you're like, he seems like he's playing it very normal and cool and collective. And he's like, hey, or look at my little town. And hey, look at the yellow brick road. Or is it a red brick road? Or is it a purple black road? And he does that whole moon mm-hmm. sequence behind the curtain and it's very whimsical and he plays it really well and I'm like, okay, your weirdness actually fits in this spot. So yeah, I had no problem with Goldblum actually being the wizard in this.
Now that role will continue into the next film, will assume. What did you think, Michelle Yeoh as Madame Morrible, which Here's what I don't like about trailers, okay? There's a couple things about the trailer, especially for this movie, that bugged me. One, they did not. I went back and looked at every trailer release. They did not advertise it as a part one at any point. But when the title comes up, it literally says part one. That pisses me off, okay? Put that. I realize
better than having it say to be continued at the end, like Spider-Verse.
No, I get that, but I'm saying like a lot of people had no idea walking in that it was. The people literally said it in the theater out loud. Wait, it's to be continued? It's going to be to be continued? You know, so I know they didn't do a very good job, or they intentionally didn't advertise that. But also the trailer, they show Michelle Yeoh being the one that says Wicked Witch of the West, like basically
making
that proclamation. So you know right. She's going to be bad. And I didn't like that because I might have been invested in the fact that she wasn't bad. And that kind of ruined that for me. It took away the surprise. But she was very good.
Bad versus good is dependent on the person's perspective.
Yeah, right? I say it was bad.
Michelle Yeoh is saying to them, based on what she's done, they're basically giving the people an enemy. So she's not necessarily bad. She's just redirecting. But she's not necessarily a bad person or a bad villain.
So you're saying there's more complexity to these characters still to come.
Correct.
Okay. No, I'm interested. All right. So maybe we'll get more backstory of her going forward?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. Maybe and I should have went so musical.
And also it's like, you know, why is she a sorcerer teacher when she doesn't actually do any sorcery?
Well, yeah, I loved how she claimed the magic as her own, by the way. That was interesting. They needed a real steward of magic to get this done, is the problem.
Correct.
To cause fear into people, because they need a threat to keep people in line, right? Which is
correct.
Very much
the what books are actually I'm glad it says fascist. The books are very much a Nazi overtone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, isn't that a fascist society? Basically, they're using fear to keep people in place. That's what they're doing. Right. Right. That's exactly what I'm getting from it.
Yeah. And the wizard's basically trying to become like a monarchy.
Yeah. I saw it. I just looked at a couple of reviews before we popped on here and I'm like, and I don't read them. I just read the headlines. Right. And even in the headlines, a couple of them were making about politics. And I'm like, this thing is 20 years old. Can we not equate it to today? And just go into something without any political mindset. Fascism has been around for a long time. You don't need to bring it up right now. It equates to cross history.
It was there in 77 in space.
Yeah, all kinds of places and spaces and time. But again, love the cast. Jonathan Bailey, again, really impressed me. That I like that burgeoning relationship between Fierro and Elfie. I really kind of like where that's going, even though she's totally breaking the friend rules. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Yep. Just a little bit. Galalalinda is going to be pissed. Sorry.
Just slightly.
Overall thoughts of the production and direction. I think we kind of have talked about it, but what were your favorite moments? Like, because you've seen the musical, what really just brought out the awe in you to see it brought to life?
I'm always big for like the big dance ensemble numbers. So the entire No One Mourns the Wicked opening in Munchkinland, I thought was just super fantastically done.
Even though you couldn't understand the damn song.
Well, the song isn't really the Ariana Grande part.
Mm-hmm.
It's everybody else and what they're singing. So that it was there and it was kind of like, that's annoying, but I kind of tuned it out because I'm watching all the dancing and the choreography and the movement of all the pieces and the brooms and the food and the carts and it's like there's just so much going on that I'm like, wow, that's how you open up a show right there. But the Dancing Through Life, when Fierro comes in and they're in the library.
Oh, that was a good set piece. Yeah,
that was so well done. I mean, he's tap dancing on books and using books to slide around on the ground, and they have the spinning bookcase in the background, which is like a focal point of how they're doing dance moves and swinging back and forth and switching up partners. And it was all of that was just such like, wow, the choreography is amazing. Like amazing. And then I think the part that was really great was at the end of the movie, when they're trying to run away from the wizard and go up into the attic, and she puts the broom in front of the door to kind of lock the door. And then they're kind of like squabbling with each other, like in normal speak. Mm-hmm. And as they're squabbling, it was like, I hope you're happy now. And it just rolls right into the music. It was just like, wow, that transition was like chills. Like that was really great how you just went right into the song, you know, as you're like yelling at each other versus having that dramatic pause. And then the music key kicks in. So like those three moments were really great. Flying sequences were okay. Like they were pretty well done, but definitely like it felt Man of Steel, Superman-ish in a few ways.
Yeah.
But sure. It works.
I do like that the broomstick is basically a freaking lightsaber. Like she's just sitting there like Luke Skywalker and it's just vibrating coming to her closer and like, oh, this is the source of her power. Okay. Well, it's a broomstick. That's bitching. That was cool.
Well, and the broomstick becomes the power because she reads the spell from the book. Yeah, and she tries to give herself wings, just like she gave the monkey wings. And then even Glinda's like, where are your wings? I guess you're not as powerful. And then the broomstick just kind of like comes to her. like drawn together kind of thing, which was, it was really cool how it was done.
It's very cool. My favorite part of the movie is, believe it or not, a very calm moment, which is the moment where she shows up at the dance and she's doing the kind of impromptu
Tai Chi.
Yeah, basically, whatever that was, minor dance of sorts. And then you get Glinda to join in and it ends up becoming quite a thing. And I just thought that was, it was surprisingly touching. It was a rather beautiful moment. And Arrivo, just like her command of her emotions in that moment and containing her both mix of anger and hurt.
Sadness.
Yeah. Like combining all that in her face. Like she just, I thought she did just a masterful job in that scene.
And then shedding the tear so that Glinda can wipe the tear away.
Yep. That was so perfect. It was just a very beautiful moment. And for two characters I didn't care much about, honestly. I'm just like, okay. Walking into the movie, I was enamored with both of them by the end of the movie. And that scene in particular gave both of them a different level of humanity that they needed. Like, you already had one from Elfie because she was already established as this very empathetic, emotional character with also a healthy amount of rage. But Glinda was a very one-note character until that moment. So
she
needed to be fleshed out, and that was a perfect moment and perfectly played. And Ariana Grande did a fantastic job with that as well, of just bringing that collision of emotion that I think really clicked to make them seem as they, you know, the two best friends that anyone could have. Like, it all made sense at that point.
Except yet not, because the only reason she befriended her was because she got her into the program. So keep that in mind. Like, there was still ulterior motive there, because she had just found out from Michelle Yeoh's character, right? From Madame Morrible. Like, oh yeah, your friend vouched for you, so you're in the program, and here's your wand.
No. That came before
and then
that.
And then she comes down the stairs, and then she's like,
I don't think that's true. I think you have the timing wrong.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because at the end of the dance, they walk up the stairs and they leave the ballroom. I'll let you know in a couple of days if you're listening to this, because I'm actually going on opening night just because I want to go see it with the rest of the crowd.
With the rest of the crowd, huh?
Yeah.
Was it not crowded when you went there?
Oh, it was crowded, but there wasn't, like, I was expecting people to sing along, clap, cheer. There's one moment where people actually went in a collective gasp.
I like those.
But yeah, it was very subdued. More than I thought it would be. So I'm thinking that, like, Thursday night and Friday night, there's going to be a lot more ruckus. At least I hope so. Because when Dancing Through Time was done, I literally like put my arms up in the air and I was like very quietly tapping my hands together, clapping. That's awesome. Like, I want to stand up right now, but nobody else is standing up right now. Why is nobody else standing up right now? It's like, okay, I'll just sit here.
I had a lot of young girls in princess dresses that were in my screen. I thought
that was
really sweet.
There was a lot of kids.
Yeah, it was really sweet to see that. And it makes me kind of want to go see it again with a big crowd, you know, just to see what a real crowd would bring to, what kind of energy they'd bring to it. Will it be like an Avengers or an Avatar? Is this one that's going to carry through the holidays? You seem to think it's going to be a massive hit, right? And I think it's going to be a big hit, but you think it's going to be massive.
Yeah, I mean, I think the musical people, once the musical people see how good it is, I think the musical people are going to drive it and like go see it multiple times. I bet you're going to have sing-along version released within like 4 weeks.
4 weeks. All right. Well, we'll find out very soon. Very soon. So should people see this in a theater?
Oh, hell yeah. See it in IMAX. See it in mega screen. See it in Dolby Cinema. Like, don't see it on a small side theater.
Oh, man.
Like,
I saw it in IMAX. That was perfect. Yeah.
IMAX was like the best. I think it was the best format to see it in, to be honest.
And you're okay with the ending on it to be continued, yeah?
I mean, I still don't get how they did 2 hours and 40 minutes and it only felt the first act. I just, like, my brain is not calculating the time. Like, I keep going back to, like, what was added?
So you don't, just, like, it doesn't just jump out in your mind what the extra was?
No, it doesn't.
Huh.
It really doesn't. It's like there was more dialogue, maybe. I mean, there's some pausing in the songs to reflect on something or looking at some, you know, scenery piece or whatever, you know, so there is some drawn outness of the songs themselves, but the drawn outness isn't drawn out. It's like intentional with purpose, and it makes sense because there's things that I can look at and there's things I can sing along with and things that I can hum along with while whatever's happening on screen is happening. So like, I was blown away that it didn't feel like 2 hours and 40 minutes.
All right. Well, you heard it here. It's going to be a massive hit. So I think people are going to see this multiple times over the Thanksgiving and upcoming holidays. It might even play through Christmas, you know?
Oh, we didn't even talk about the Easter eggs.
Go for it. Let's go.
There's a part, I think it was during Popular, when she pulls out a pair of shoes. Mm-hmm. And as the shoes are out, you're like, oh my gosh, it's the ruby slippers. And then the notes are like perfectly timed where she actually clicks the heels together three times as she's singing the song. And I literally was like, oh my God, that's great. And I turned to Tracy. I was like, did you see it? And Tracy's like, see what? And I was like, it was the ruby slippers. They clicked it three times. How did you miss it?
She missed that? I thought that was so obvious.
She missed it. I was like, what? What?
No, there's a lot of nods to the original movie.
So
which
many
is,
nods.
Which is funny because I don't think Universal has the rights to the actual movie, the original movie. I think it's
a Warner Brothers.
But
I don't know.
But the other big cameos were who?
Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel show up in the most crazy, fantastical way when they get to the Emerald City, and they're given like the history of the Emerald City and the history of the wizard. And when they come popping up and they just show up out of nowhere, like that's when the whole crowd just went, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, and the sequence that they do together is just flipping magical.
Like, they had great chemistry.
Great
chemistry.
Yeah. It literally like reminded you of what it looked like when they were on stage. And just the back and forth and like, I'm better than you. No, you're better than me. Kind of like one-upping in this whole performance that they're doing. It was really super, like it was spot on. It's like the best place they could have put him in for the cameo.
Oh, I did like Bowen Yang too. I thought Bowen Yang was good.
Yeah.
And Buck. Buck. He's a sweet guy. I'll do anything for you, Glinda, including going out with this young lady over here. And then he comes to really appreciate her, it seems like. So
he does.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's wicked. Oh, I'm so excited. And we did not see Gladiator 2 by the time you hear this, and we are taking the next week off. So let's just say I've heard from multiple people it's very, very good. Go check it out, whichever one you're in the mood for. But it's nice to have something that
I like to know who you're talking to, because the reviews are saying it's really, really bad.
Well, I've talked to three people now that have seen it, and they liked it. They said it was great. So you know what? I saw a review that said Wicked sucked. Guess what? It didn't. It just didn't. They called it messy and overly political. That was actually a review from a major outlet. So they just
overly political. That clearly they did not read the source material, because of course it's overly political. The whole source material is overly political.
I'm just letting you know.
That means it was a good thing if it was overly political, because it means it hit the mark.
Go watch the things you want to watch and enjoy them. Damn it. That's what I'm saying. And this is worth seeing in a theater. I'm telling you, as somebody, I like musicals. I don't love them. Troy loves them. We both had a great time. So go see Wicked. And that's going to do it for this episode. Everybody have a wonderful holiday, Thanksgiving, right? We're thankful for all of you. So keep sharing the love, and make sure you tell your friends about this podcast. That would be wonderful. That's going to do it for this episode of The Hollywood Outsider. And remember, the next time you see The Wicked, not The Wicked, just Wicked, in theaters, buy popcorn. Yeah, I didn't say stream comfortably from your couch, because get your ass up and go see this in the theater. It's worth it.
Totally worth it.
Please.